friends. Welcome to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
And today we're very hyped to be joined by the excellent film lad, Anna Bogutskaya. Anna, hello.
Hello. Absolutely love being introduced as the excellent film lad. I'm sealing that and forever putting that on my business cards and email signatures.
It's what you are. So before we get into the book, would you like to just, you know, describe yourself in better detail than Excellent Film Lad?
I think Excellent Film Lad really sums it up. I've referred to myself as a professional film nerd, which is both who I am as a human being and what I do professionally. I'm a writer, author now, and film critic, broadcaster, podcaster. I basically write and talk about film and TV in any medium that will have me in any way, shape, or form. I review films, I write a lot of essays about films, history, movie culture, and I also do a lot of kind of interviews and podcasts. I'm one of those people who's constantly hosting Q&As, so I'm on that circuit. And I'm a film programmer, so I used to be the film programmer for the BFI, and since leaving, I'm now programming for the Edinburgh International Film Festival and Fantastic Fest over in the US. So those are my three main things. I write, I talk, I put films in cinemas and festivals. So everything revolves around movies for me. I'm like a one-trick pony, except that, you know, I'm jumping around in different mediums, but always back to the same thing.
Cool. Would you like to tell us about the book, Unlikable Female Characters?
Well, it's very much... It's very much a long-standing project for me. I think it's something that I started noticing very early on. I started the book kind of with a childhood anecdote as well about being given a book as a kid by my parents that was a manual, a how-to instruction manual on how to be a girl. And I very much scoffed at it and threw it away or hid it somewhere, being like, well, that's like... is this why are there special rules for me and not for, you know, the boys? Like, why are they allowed to do whatever they want, and I have these invisible rules that I seem to need to follow? But really it comes from just an affinity with certain kind of characters that have been deemed sort of bitchy or pushy or too much or psychotic or just crazy or killjoys or shrewy. So there's a lot of sort of you know, words that are either very loudly or very quietly gendered and have a lot of implications to them that are never quite discussed and are never really explained. You just have to get to with the program or you're ostracized. And that obviously applies to women in everyday life, but I'm mostly interested throughout the book in fictional characters. So female characters in films and movies and a little bit kind of, you know, outsized pop culture figures like your Madonnas or your Lana Del Reys or, you know, people like that, where they become artifacts and arbiters of pop culture. And I mostly was interested with the book at looking at how they created codes for behavior and things that we kind of call tropes, you know, these certain rules that made us categorize them into, you know, you're a bitch or you're a slut or you're a crazy woman or you're a psycho, and how that has been happening basically since the invention of cinema. And in the last like 10 or so years, and especially really concentrated in the last 5 years or so, we've really seen sort of a renaissance of what we used to just blanket term as unlikable female characters. Now that's become a sort of a selling point. You know, we see it on posters. We see it as in constant headlines. We see it as an appealing point. You know, the fact that we want to see women or female characters more like kind of being provocative and compelling and disgusting and violent and flawed as characters. And that is that kind of tendency and that trend was really interesting to me to explore a bit in depth and to go back into pop culture history and look at how those expectations, those tropes, and those invisible rules became a thing, and how, and try to understand, which, to be honest, even though I've written the book, I still don't, because it's an absolute nonsense concept, what this idea of the unlikable female character might actually mean, and whether it actually has any meaning, or we've just used it as a catch-all term for any woman that we decide not to like, be she fictional or real.
It's certainly huge in literature as well right now. Yeah. Like the unhinged woman trope is,
oh god, yeah,
all over TikTok. Like it's having its a moment. What was the origin story, the situation with the bitch events?
Oh, so that's that I talk about it briefly in the book, and that was I curated a season, a repertory season. So that's kind of old films for the BFI when I was working there, and that it was called Playing the Bitch, and that had a bit of controversy around it, and it was interesting. It was really interesting in so many different ways, because A, why would a 10 film repertory program cause any controversy? That in itself is a wild occurrence. And on the other hand, kind of, it really made me and invited me to kind of sit down, listen, speak to a lot of people, speak to a lot of really smart people, writers, curators, critics, and create kind of events that were, you know, the design of that season was to invite a conversation, and a conversation did happen. And actually those events during that season had a lot of people who had extremely strong opinions about what they felt about those kinds of kind of, you know, negative representations in film history, about the use of that word to describe them, about the legacy of those kind of bitchy characters. Some people were very against it and felt that kind of those harmful connotations of the B word could never be reclaimed and could never be really softened in any way. And made very compelling arguments, and I completely see where they're coming from. And then other people were talking about how that was a kind of character that had become empowering, or if not empowering, which is a complicated, slightly foo-foo word at this point in our where we live with pop culture feminism and all that. It was a kind of character that was very compelling, very fun to watch, and was, for lack of a better word, extremely memorable. You know, those are the kind of female characters that we remember, not the quote unquote strong female characters that are just perfect by whatever we decide in any given point in our culture or history that makes a woman perfect, because that will change as well as time goes on. We remember these kind of, you know, the cruel ones, the villainous ones, the bitchy ones. They have the best lines. They have the juiciest characters. They give the most memorable performances. You know, they make actresses into stars. They get them the award nominations. So there was a big, another kind of big subsection of people who were really, really defending kind of the use of this word and the use of the bitch kind of as a trope in and of itself. So after that project, I really started to, well, I was actually inspired by my boss at the time, who just offhandedly mentioned, I think you're not done with this project yet, and I think there's maybe a book in there. And I started thinking about it for years, about what that would look like, what that would mean, whether it's just this one type of you know, bitchy female character that I was interested in, or whether there was other kind of, you know, unlikable female characters or tropes that could be explored that had different kinds of reactions to them, that had different kinds of impacts. You know, one of my favorite unlikable female characters is Alex Forrest from Fatal Attraction, which was, you know, the Glenn Close movie from 87, and it has now been remade or reimagined into a TV show just this year, starring Alice Kaplan. And I find her deeply, deeply compelling. And the fact that the way that she was performed by Glenn Close was so nuanced and detailed and empathetic, but the way that she was remembered and really, you know, the impact that she made on pop culture at that time and since then was so monumental and so huge, it didn't really correlate. You know, like those two things being true at once is very difficult for us to understand as people. And definitely kind of when we're talking about media and pop culture. So someone really defending this character who became the villain and the female villain of multiple decades was kind of, you know, something that I found a gray area that I found really exciting to explore, and also to think about a lot of these movies and these characters that I had, you know, perhaps also just put into this one box of, oh, she's such a bitch and I love her for that, and kind of delving a little bit deeper into the actresses that portrayed them, the script and the meaning, but kind of the analysis of the movie, the context in which it was released and in which it was made, the way that it was received at the time and how that changed over the years, which, you know, is a big thing with pop culture. You know, we might think something is one thing when it comes out, you know, because of who we are, where we're at and the way that it's marketed. And then years later, we'll revisit it and discover engage in a completely different reading on it of it. So that's kind of the way that it evolved from that one mildly controversial 10 film repertory season, which again, just the combination of controversial and repertory season just seems like a wild occurrence.
So the book is divided into sections around like different types of unlikable female characters, like the bitch or the psycho or the slut. Was one of the sections like a particular fave for you to write?
I would say probably the longest chapter in the book is the bitch. And I would say that would be my favorite one to write, mainly because it made me, it is such a big term with such a complicated history. And it is such a catch-all term at times for any sort of female villainous figure, that breaking that up and making sure that she was distinct and different from all the other tropes, I think that was the most fun for me to write. And also I got to write about one of my favorite female characters of all time, Bridget Gregory from The Last Seduction.
Which I have not seen, but I am now keen to see.
Yeah, I
haven't seen that one either. Oh, please do. It's such a banger. It's just a perfect, perfect movie.
So I want to circle back around to something that you just said at the end of your last answer, talking about like the way that pop culture is constantly evolving, right? Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you had to change the book much as you were writing it, or if anything new was unearthed as you were sort of working through it.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, the thing is, when you're writing about sort of contemporary pop culture, and the book is really structured around sort of these seminal films or seminal TV shows, and as contemporary as basically the moment in which I was writing it. So I was still watching stuff and including stuff that was really literally airing or being released at the time that I was writing it. And I just had the deadline cutoff point and I couldn't include more stuff after that, because if not, even since I finished the actual book, the manuscript, so much more has come out that I would have happily and gladly included in there. I mean, just, you know, the whole of Succession, I had seen up until the end of season 3 at that time and wrote extensively about Siobhan Roy in the book. But, you know, that's a complete, like, adds so much different, so many different layers into it that I wasn't able to include. But it did completely change. And at some point, I did have to really be strict with myself to be like, you cannot keep up with stuff that is happening as you're writing. So it was much more important for me to be rooted in a bit more of a historical detail. So kind of looking back at pop culture where I could have the benefit of hindsight and also the reception at that time.
So I'd actually written this question for like later in, you know, further down my list of questions, but given that it's kind of relevant to what you're talking about, and you've already mentioned Fatal Attraction and The Last Seduction, Something I'm super, super interested in is the erotic thriller.
Oh, God.
And it feels like we're in a moment now where there's an attempted comeback of erotic thrillers, but it seems like they're not really landing. Like the Ben Affleck, Ana de Armas, Deep Water, I thought that was going to be like the beginning of like a new thing, and it just wasn't great. And now I haven't heard anybody talking about the new Fatal Attraction adaptation, even though like Lizzie Kaplan objectively rules. And I think there's a lot of goodwill for Joshua Jackson. So it's really interesting. Like, what do you think is like not hitting? Like, can you figure out why now? Why not now?
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts on this. And also, apologies, I called her, misnamed her earlier. It's Lizzie Kaplan. I'm a big fan of the erotic thriller from the 80s and 90s. It's one of my top genres. And I've desperately been wanting it to come back. And every single new thing that comes out, I'm like, is this the one? Deepwater was supposed to be the one because it's also directed by Adrian Lyne, who basically, you know, formulated one of the accidental masterminds of the erotic thriller formula. There was also Obsession on Netflix last month, I believe. There's the Fatal Attraction series. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that's come out and kind of gone away. It doesn't really click. And I've written about this all over the place. I've written about this in The Face and New Statesman and Huck Magazine. They keep trying to bring back the erotic thriller, but it's neither thrilling and, most importantly, it's not erotic. The actors can be great. The premise or the source material can be great. You know, Deepwater is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. Like, it, the source material is fine. And Fatal Attraction is one of the most recognizable and influential erotic thrillers there is. And you'd think that with all of the progress that we've made and how we discuss mental health issues and the very simple perspective change of let's make it from her point of view and not from his, and we're no longer hindered by the same requirements and the star power that, you know, the original team had. You know, Glenn Close wasn't that well-known an actress. Michael Douglas was a massive star and a massive producer. So there was a power imbalance that really lent towards making his character likable. And yet the show basically does the same thing, but over the course of 10 episodes, and gives a bit more depth to Alex's character, but still punishes her. And again, I go back to my initial point, and it's so simple. They're just not erotic. They're not hot. They really aren't. In Deepwater, and I know that Ana de Armas and Ben Affleck were sort of breaking up at that point when they were making the film, but seriously, you have an actual couple and there is zero sizzle between them. How does Ben Affleck have more chemistry with his fucking slugs than he does with Ana de Armas in that film? And don't even get me started on an Obsession, because that is a ridiculous farce of a fucking erotic thriller show. I cannot contain my rage about it, because the mismatch of the actors, the absolute nonsense of that script, the fact that it's a TV series for absolutely no reason when it's basically just a badly edited 2-hour long movie. None of it is that difficult, and yet they keep failing at it. And I genuinely think it might be because we have an issue with how we portray sex in movies and sex in TV shows. It is rare now to find like a show or a TV series that is genuinely hot, that kind of, you know, we tried that with Don't Worry Darling, didn't really work, did it? We keep trying it with different erotic thrillers, but there's no danger and no sexual tension. So the main two ingredients of the genre that are in the name are never there. So of course they fail. The story's shit. And then the actors don't really have any chemistry.
It makes you just want to go and watch Body Heat.
Okay. Literally. And that's always a better decision.
Yeah.
In the cut.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Also, so do you think, I'm going to skip ahead slightly, Bethy, if you don't mind.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was going to suggest that.
Yeah. Do you think at the minute, like, we as a society, as film fans, as readers, are we in a better position right now? Are we ready, like, more politically mindful to have these conversations? Or are we kind of less ready? Are we in a more reactionary like place than ever before to like start approaching these conversations about these characters in this way?
Are you talking about unlikable female characters in general or about erotic thrillers specifically?
Yeah. Oh, you know, both, because it flows perfectly. like I was just thinking particularly about what we were talking about, sex just then, like sex on screen. Is a really like hot topic right now on the internet.
It is.
Like there was that viral that was like the teens want one thing and it's the Hays Code. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of two separate questions, aren't they? On the one hand, are we done with even the idea of unlikability? I would think we are, but then we still have those articles. We still have these trends that kind of reappear. You know, even the unhinged women thing on BookTok that is everywhere and is very much kind of a trend. But now it's sort of shifted from a punishing perspective to almost a marketing thing, right? You know, give me the books, give me the films with unhinged female leads. Give me these unhinged women. I want to read more about feral women. I want to read about them going berserk. You know, I want to see them on screen as well. So I think that we're in the middle of a shift of perspective where the things that we used to punish, we're now actively seeking out. And then companies and, you know, screenwriters, directors, whatever, are then tapping into that to sell it back to us. Now, the difficulty becomes when it just becomes a marketing ploy, you know, something like Cruella, which basically just used the born bad kind of, you know, I'm a bitch, I'm mad and I'm bad kind of as a marketing selling point. And the film itself is kind of very vacuous and very slight and not very fun either. I mean, if you think about Glenn Close's Cruella de Vil, she's truly evil to the point where there is no redeeming qualities in her whatsoever. And she's extremely fun to watch. And don't get me wrong, the outfits in Cruella with Emma Stone are fabulous, but there is no character there. So there's not really that much for us to latch on to except some slogans that are telling us that she's bad and mad and, you know, very evil. But we're not really seeing it or feeling it. So I think we are in the middle of that perspective change. And it comes, I think, from both sides, from the creators, a lot more, not that many, but still more female showrunners, screenwriters, directors, actresses with more power and also more vocal and more choosy about the sort of characters that they're picking and that they want to play. You know, there's a big difference between, you know, everyone rejecting the role like Alex Forrest and actresses now seeking out those kind of roles because they have more to them. So it is more of a challenge and they connect with audiences. Audiences know they don't want to be like Cersei Lannister, but they enjoy watching her. They enjoy analyzing her. Same with Shiv Roy. You know, she's not a likable person. She's not a good person, but she's a great character. And people are more media literate to the point where they can distinguish between a great performance by Sarah Snook from a truly, you know, deeply flawed, deeply unlikable, deeply problematic character that she's portraying. Us understanding that divide a bit better, I think, really helps. What also helps is obviously social media and its content creators and its critics who are both professional or amateur or critics who have created their own platforms and speak directly to audiences. You know, YouTube is full of video essays about variations on unlikability or unhinged female characters or feral girls, you know, all the different buzzy words that will change depending on the season. But the element, the core truth of it is still the same. They want to see female characters that have meat on their bones, that have like something to chew on, that have substance, and that are not just vacuous images of perfection that are being essentially fed to female audiences as well as, well, you can only be this kind of woman and everything else is wrong. And the erotic thriller question, I think, is a bit more... I really wish I knew the answer because then I could just sell it to Netflix or someone and be like, this is what you need to do to bring back the erotic thriller. But I do genuinely think it's just misguided combinations at the moment. And I do think we're in a really weird, both very puritanical and very sleazy era in pop culture where people get deeply offended about sex on screen to the point where, you know, there is... people consider it sort of, some people, at least on Twitter, have even raised the idea that they consider it a violation of consent to be subjected to a sex scene in a film or show that they hit play on. But I don't want to get into that. That's for a whole nother different conversation. And at the same time, stuff like The Idol is going to come out and has massive support from and massive budget behind it. And something like The Idol is just pure sleaze. It's basically one step removed from porn. But there it's just explicit. There's no titillation. And I think there is a difference between being explicit and being erotic. And the erotic thrillers at the time, you know, when you look at them, very often, like, there's the, you know, the nudity is whatever, you know, is acceptable or whatever you get in kind of movies in a particular period. That will change as time goes on. Some of them are explicit, but not as much as, say, what we're able to see now, but they're so deeply erotic. And that, I think, comes down to story, to character, to performances, not just putting one body part or another on screen.
Because that's something that I, you know, over the course of reading the book, I was sort of thinking about a lot was, I guess, the difference between a character that's like morally bad but fun to watch and characters that are like morally good but not fun to watch. So like the difference between, you know, like the response to like Skyler White, which was obviously completely outsized and ridiculous on Breaking Bad. But like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not necessarily about like the moral position of the characters. It's, it goes kind of further back to like the writing or the, so it's like, it's a combination of like, what do we want to see people doing, but also who is writing them and how are they writing them?
Yeah, totally. I think the three key players in the book for me are the writers, the performers, so the actresses, and the audience. Because they can, you know, they can intend one thing and the audience will receive it in a different way, or they can read through the lines, read between the lines and grasp onto those characters. And, you know, like, again, going back to Fatal Attraction, Alex Forrest is written in one way, but Glenn Close's performance finds and gives her so much life between the lines. That's all on her, of giving her that much heart and that much vulnerability and not playing her as a straight up, you know, black and white villain where she has no humanity, no character, and just kind of no redemption whatsoever. But all of that comes to the performance. And then there's the reaction to her, you know, the way, and it's been very, very well documented, the way that, you know, it was massively successful financially, but also people would have this huge, you know, a very vocal reaction to screenings. They'd be like yelling, kill the bitch at the screen. And that's why notoriously the ending to the movie changed from Alex committing suicide and framing Michael Douglas's character Dan for her murder as, you know, the ultimate punishment, or teaching him the extreme consequences of his actions and his dismissal of her, to her being killed by his wife. And I realized I should have given a spoiler warning to a film from 1987. But it is, you know, that came from test audiences, that came from people being like, we want to see her punished. And that reaction is just as fascinating, because that reaction to fictional characters, that extreme violent reaction, is really telling of a particular time. And the way that it changes is also really telling. You know, the fact that, you know, people like me, audiences like me, and so many more can really look at Alex and see a woman in distress or a woman in a crisis as opposed to a crazy villain, is a very different reading from screaming, kill the bitch at the screen. And you know, you can see that in more recent cases like Skyler White. But then you look at the polar opposite, you know, look at what's been happening with Joe Goldberg and You, where everybody has been fawning over this man who's a stalker and a serial killer, to the point where even the actor who's playing him be like, you guys are not okay. This is not what we intended. This is not the correct reaction, but okay. And that's really funny, and it's very memeable and makes for great sort of, you know, BuzzFeed video interviews. But I do find that audience reaction to be really, really interesting, precisely for this, precisely because of how it might have been intended versus how it was received.
Okay, here's a question for you. And maybe you won't have an answer to this. Okay. But do you feel like perhaps in your reckless youth or in the past, have you ever fallen into that trap? Like, have you ever felt there's like a fictional character that you had a really strong reaction to in the past that actually now you kind of want to atone for?
That's a great question. You know what? I was thinking a lot about her recently, and I'm going to say Tracy Flick from Election. I did another podcast promoting the book and talking about her, and I've read about her in the book as well. And she's one who I think we all collectively, and myself included, when I watched that film, I was like, oh my God, she's so annoying. Like, of course.
Yeah.
She's the villain of Election. And then the more I've thought about it, and since rewatching the film, you know, a couple of times over the course of my life, and most recently for the book, and then again for this podcast, I was like, wow, Tracy is she's literally a child. She's a teenager. And she plays her as a very naive, innocent, really striving teenager. And it reminded me of, you know, not to go back to Succession all the time, but that's all I'm thinking about recently. It really reminded me of her reaction to Jeremy Strong and that New Yorker profile as well, where we're like, oh, fuck him. He's so annoying. I'm like, why? He's just a very, you know, ambitious, dedicated dude. Good for him. He's a striver. He needs to be. He doesn't just have a career handed to him. And I thought about him a lot when I was rewatching Election. I'm like, okay, I remember being like, oh, she's too much. She's so annoying. I hate her. She's the villain. And it was like, wow, she's literally a teenager who was molested by one of her high school teachers. And then his buddy, who is also one of her teachers, tried to sabotage her little high school election. How is she the villain? So I think I'd like to apologize to Tracy Flick.
That was such a good answer.
Yeah, I'm glad you thought of one. So you touched on it earlier, Alice, regarding TikTok, but I thought it was really interesting to kind of take our perspective on cinema all the way back to the production code of the 1930s. To what extent do you think that that has like informed what we are left with now? Like, do you think that that is casting like a very long shadow on the characters that we get to see?
I think yes. And I think that's inevitable. And I think it is very, I mean, that's extremely tied to Hollywood and American film production. But I think those movies have such a huge influence on, you know, on global pop culture and global cinema. You know, they're not the end all be all of cinema anywhere. But we have to accept that there is a self-built mythos around Hollywood and those movies and the way that they reach us. So I think there is, and you know, you mentioned it, Alice, earlier as well. Everything the teenagers want is the Hays Code back, and we're making the joke, but we're kind of seeing that in this new puritanism that we're seeing around sex on screen and what's quote unquote acceptable or not. And the Hays Code encompassed a lot more things and was very, very rooted in institutional racism and homophobia and in misogyny. So that's taking us a long time to unpick. It's not fully unpicked, not in real life, and definitely not on pop culture. So I think there is. I think there absolutely is a long shadow cast by that production code. And despite, you know, the contradictions that we're seeing right now, I think there is still sometimes a gut reaction that we have that's instinctive and that's, you know, rooted in a lot of really difficult, complicated, contradictory messaging that we receive, especially as women, where we have almost like a pearl clutching reaction where we can be like, oh, you can't possibly show that. And then thinking about why we have that reaction is what I find quite curious.
Earlier on, we talked about Cruella. Mm-hmm. And you said something that kind of resonated with something that comes up in the book about backstories, which mm-hmm. I thought would be fun to about. So do you think that like unlikable female characters are often given a traumatic backstory to explain why they are violent or unpleasant or, you know, whatever? Do you think that the lack of backstory is what makes characters like Villanelle and Amy Dunn so much fun to watch?
I think so. I mean, you tell me, as well as a writer of unlikable female characters, I do think there is an, I don't think this applies only to female characters. I think this is a recurrent narrative device that we should retire or just use sparingly, because giving a tragic backstory, very more often than not rooted in some form of abuse, just A, I think it's gotten to a point where it's tried and it's repetitive and it doesn't have the desired effect. And B, I think it's overplaying the same kind of traumas, which again downplay their effect, both narrative and kind of just their visibility. And also, what is the point of that? Is that to excuse someone's behavior? Is that to explain it? Is that to... I think it's a kind of lazy attempt of making a character complicated when you haven't actually written a well-rounded enough character.
It kind of reminds me of that, the line from Scream about Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, do we know why Hannibal Lecter likes eating people? No.
No.
It doesn't matter.
No. No, not at all. And obviously Hannibal Lecter also did that with Hannibal Rising and then the TV show and tried to give him a backstory. Exactly. I often forget about it because it made me so mad reading it. I'm like, I don't want to know about this little sister. Like, I don't care. I want more cannibal adventures, not like cannibal trauma. Just make him want to eat meat. That's like human meat. That's all I need from him.
Yeah. And what about Amy Dunn?
Yeah, I love thinking about Gone Girl, and I loved, that was one of my favorite elements of the book, was any discussion of Gone Girl, Amy Dunn. So I would love to hear some chat about Gone Girl from you.
I mean, how great is she, both the book character and the film version of the character? It's one of my favorite adaptations. I just appreciate for a moment the absolutely stone cold perfect casting of that movie. Ben Affleck as Nick Dunn.
I had no idea that Reese Witherspoon was originally, you know, that it was her production company and that she considered playing Amy herself. I cannot picture that.
Me either. Reese Witherspoon is such a smart producer. She has, I mean, she built her sort of producing empire and that on optioning these books so early on, knowing that they would be kind of hits, having a great nose for that, but also having this, you know, this desire for more complicated female characters. And some of them, you know, I understand where the desire comes from of, you know, well, I want better roles for myself as well. And that has a lot to do with also be, you know, there's a lot of conversation. There was, this is an unfortunate kind of Hollywood thing that's been the same since, well, its inception, of as soon as an actress becomes a quote unquote actress of a certain age, then the roles start to dry up. They become different. They're kind of the mum roles. They're less interesting. And, you know, the times have changed and people like Reese Witherspoon have been able to also take the matter into their own hands and find and create roles for themselves. But yeah, that was originally the idea. But the beauty of casting Rosamund Pike in that role is that she didn't really have, she was already a really accomplished actress, but she didn't really have that star persona in, at least definitely not in America. So she kind of came out of nowhere, so she could be anyone. You know, you didn't know whether to believe her, whether to distrust her, because, you know, imagine Reese Witherspoon as Amy Dunn, you'd find a hard time to think of her as a villain, because she's Reese Witherspoon. Like, she brings so much cultural baggage with her already. And that twist for anyone watching that film that had not read the book would have been insane. And I do just love, you know, I was thinking about the, I mean, I love watching Gone Girl at any point in the day, but there is something so deeply calculating and cold about the violence that Amy Dunn commits. She is so unfeeling about it. There's no sort of, she's not, you know, a put upon woman who snaps and kills someone, which is a narrative that we've seen a lot of movies. You know, if a woman kills, it's because something has happened to her and it's sort of justified by the thing that's happened to her. And Amy is just, it's just an inconvenience, you know, killing Desi. It's just annoying. it's a thing she has to do as opposed to something she necessarily feels feral about. And I find it even more chilling that, you know, than if she were a serial killer who, you know, got off on killing someone.
Well, we have one final question for you before we clock off. Mm. I sense maybe you have already given this answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Which unlikable female character do you hold most dear to your heart?
I think it would have to be Bridget Gregory from The Last Seduction, mainly because she's one of those, well, I really don't want to give away the ending because I deeply just want everyone listening to the show to discover that film. But she is so joyously evil, but evil in a way where she's self-serving and greedy and manipulative, but having so much fun being that. She genuinely is like one of the most selfish characters I've seen on screen, definitely depicted by a woman. And she's so, there's also like this really savage kind of class that Linda Fiorentino brings to her, the way she plays her. I get something new out of that performance every single time I watch the film. And it's fun. It's fun and it's sexy and she's got some great one-liners and she's so mean to men and basically to everyone else. And she plays around with people's perspectives on her and assumptions about her. And that is just wondrous to see on screen.
I'm sold. I'm going to watch The Last Seduction at the next available opportunity. Anna, thank you so much for your time. So Unlikable Female Characters by you, Anna Bogutskaya, is out now. And you should pick it up because I feel like this chat has been a good advertisement for the book in that, you know, if you thought this was interesting, there is 300 plus pages for you in the book to go deeper with. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Anna.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.